stroked the dog's long, silky ears. The dog closed her eyes as her companion lumbered slowly to his feet and shuffled closer, more hand-sniffing, ear-stroking. The second dog had a shorter coat but seemed equally sweet. Dee Dee wondered how Alex and Jack's dog search was coming. Coffee shop barista phoned in the report, the uniformed officer said. Officer Jenko, Dee Dee read on his uniform.
She saw the pictures on the news, recognized they matched the dogs outside. According to her, she's never seen the dogs before, doesn't know anything about the Boyd Baez family.
Dee Dee nodded, keeping her attention on the dogs. She kneeled, getting up close. Both dogs seemed well-groomed, in good condition, no sign of injury or blood spatter. She gently lifted the first dog's front leg. The shaggy spaniel didn't seem to mind, obediently holding up her paw. The foot pads appeared rough, but again no evidence of blood or trauma. Should she be bagging the dog's paws as evidence? Things they never thought to mention at the police academy. Then again, given that the dogs had walked all the way from the crime scene to here, any evidence discovered on their feet would be cross-contaminated, worthless in a court of law. Dee Dee lowered the dog's leg, went back to stroking her long ears. She could feel the dog tremble slightly beneath her fingers, press closer into Dee Dee's hand. She was anxious, Dee Dee thought. The change in schedule, a day that wasn't like the day before. The dogs knew something was up. They just didn't know how bad yet.
"Working on canvassing the area for potential witnesses now," Phil was saying from behind her.
"Hang on." Dee Dee had just found it. A square of paper folded up tight, wedged beneath the dog's collar. She eased it out, unfolded the note carefully. "My name is Rosie," Dee Dee read out loud. The shaggy dog lifted her ears at the sound of her name. "I am a 12-year-old Brittany Spaniel. I'm blind but gentle. I like to be outside in sunny weather, listening to birds. Please don't separate me from my friend Blaze. If found, you can call..." Dee Dee rattled off the number, then frowned and looked at Phil. He dialed the number while she inspected the second dog's collar. Sure enough, "I am Blaze," she read, "a 10-year-old Brittany Spaniel. I'm blind but a very good boy. I love to be outside with my friend Rosie. If found..." "The number belongs to Hector Alvalos," Phil reported, lowering his phone. Dee Dee straightened slowly. Both dogs moved in closer, pressed against her legs. So much for her dark jeans, which would now be covered in white and brown hairs. She supposed she should get used to such things.
"Why Hector Alvalos?" Dee Dee asked.
"I don't know. He's not answering his phone."
Phil paused.
"He knows the dogs, visiting the house to pick up Manny each weekend. Maybe he watches them sometimes."
"Most people put their home numbers on their dogs' collars," Dee Dee countered, "or their phones. Given that Roxana didn't..."
"It's as if she already knew there wasn't a home for them to return to,"
Phil finished for her.
"Anyone know exactly what time the dogs showed up?"
"Best estimate is sometime around 10, but most of those patrons are gone by now. We're going to need to pull all receipts from 9:30 on, then call those customers and have them return to be interviewed. Someone saw something, and we need to know what."
"Or," Phil replied, "we could review the security camera footage. Mrs. Shupp is loading it up for us now."
"Or," Dee Dee agreed, "we do that."
Phil gestured toward the coffee shop. Dee Dee fell in step behind him, leaving Officer Jenko, back on duty, guarding the two beautiful dogs. Linda Shupp had been running the coffee shop for 8 years. A brisk woman with wavy brown hair and hands that moved even faster than she talked, she had them in a back room and set up with a security monitor in a matter of minutes. Dee Dee wondered how much coffee the woman drank on the job. Dee Dee wished she had some of that coffee, and a moment later she did. Dee Dee really liked Linda Shupp. After producing two mugs of latte, the woman left Dee Dee and Phil to their own devices. She had a shop packed with caffeine-addicted patrons on a sunny Saturday morning. Hand still waving, she hustled out the door. Dee Dee took a moment to sip her latte, regain her bearings. "She wears a Fitbit," she murmured to Phil. "I wonder what her heart rate is at any given time."
Please. I wonder how many tens of thousands of steps she gets in each day.
Scary, Dee Dee agreed. She leaned forward and they turned their attention to the security system. Playback seemed easy enough. Phil started them at 9 a.m., then worked forward in 5-minute increments. 9:45, there were no dogs. 9:50, dogs appeared. He rewound to 9:45. They sipped their lattes and watched. 9:46, Roxana Baez appeared suddenly on camera, holding two leashes. She was already focused on the trees, not running, but walking very quickly. The moment she arrived at the small slice of greenery, she dropped to her knees and went to work on the leashes, wrapping them around the base of the tree. The girl wore jeans, a thin, long-sleeve shirt that might be red, and, of course, the backpack. The security cameras recorded in black and white, but Dee Dee thought the pack might be light blue, as the neighbor had reported. The straps were frayed, the fit snug, as if the backpack was sized for a child. Manny's backpack, or a leftover from Roxy's youth? The coffee shop had already placed a bowl of water curbside for customers with dogs. The girl grabbed it, moved it closer to her spaniels. Now they could see the side of Roxy's face. It appeared shiny, wet with sweat, tears. The girl's hands were shaking visibly as she set down the water bowl.
She looks terrified, Phil murmured.
Dee Dee didn't disagree. The girl unslung her pack, still moving quickly, paper, pen, scribbling the two notes, folding them up tight, then sticking them under each collar. The dogs were pacing, confined by their leashes, but clearly agitated. Roxy looked over her right shoulder, then her left. A short pause. Then she threw her arms around the first dog, Rosie, Dee Dee thought, then the second dog, Blaze. The girl didn't wait. She grabbed her worn pack, slung it over her shoulders, and, with a last nervous look around, took off again.
She's running, Phil said.
From what she did at her family's house, or from what she saw? They both sat back, sipped more coffee. Phil started the video again from the beginning. They watched it a second time, then a third. Then Phil advanced the video, this time in 1-minute intervals, looking for signs that Roxana Baez had doubled back, returned down the other side of the street. No dice. Next, they focused their attention on the sea of pedestrians caught in the fringe of the camera's lens, people walking down the sidewalk after Roxana Baez, probably in pursuit, maybe a neighbor or a familiar face from outside the crime scene this morning. No one jumped out at Dee Dee. She glanced at Phil, who shook his head.
Timeline, she said. We know Roxy left the house with her pack and the dogs sometime around 8:30. Numerous witnesses put the sound of shots fired at shortly after 9. And this?
The recording had a date and time stamp in the upper right corner. Places Roxy and the dogs here at 9:46. She looked at Phil.
Think it takes a teenager and her two dogs an hour and 15 minutes to walk 10 blocks?
I'd guess more like 30 minutes.
So where'd she go in between?
Are there any parks in the area? Someplace she'd logically take the dogs to play?
Or meet with someone?
Or tie the dogs up so she could circle back to the house and do what she really had planned for the morning?
And what's in the backpack? Dee Dee muttered. I want to know what's in that pack.
Phil appeared troubled.
She still looks terrified to me, and the way she tends the dogs, making sure they're in the shade, bringing them water, writing notes.
You think a girl who takes such good care of her dogs is the same kind of girl who'd gun down her own family? Her siblings?
Dee Dee knew what he meant. The sight of Lola and Manny curled up tightly in the corner of the bedroom? She'd never forget that.
We need more cameras, Dee Dee said. We need to reconstruct this girl's route minute by minute, starting at 8:30 this morning. Where did she go? Who did she meet? What did she do?
Working on it.
Where'd she go after this?
Dee Dee rewound their video again, watched Roxana stuff notes in her dog's collars, then pause for her last goodbye.
There. She takes off north. What's north of this coffee shop?
Phil shrugged.
Not my neighborhood.
Dee Dee already had out her phone, was loading up maps.
Bus stop, she announced, which would give the girl several options for escape.
Wait, here we go. A few blocks up is St. Elizabeth's Medical. Isn't that where Roxy's mom, Juanita Baez, worked?
Phil nodded.
All right, have a detective reach out to MBTA's security department. Bus lines 57 and 65. We need to check with drivers, start flashing Roxana's photo around, see if anyone remembers her boarding a bus. Does she even have a pass? Another question to answer.
Phil nodded, scribbled a note.
You and me, Dee Dee continued, we'll head to St. Elizabeth's, talk to Juanita's co-workers, figure out if she had any enemies, expressed any recent fears. Better yet, maybe she had a close friend on the job, someone who knew the family and Roxana well enough. Roxy might feel comfortable enough turning to for help.
And the dogs? Phil asked.
Dee Dee hesitated. She should call animal control, have the dogs picked up, quarantined. She could still feel Rosie and Blaze's trembling forms pressing against her legs, seeking comfort.
Leave a message for Hector, she said. If he's willing to take them, that'll work. Not to mention, it'll give us an excuse to pay a visit to his apartment later to check up on the dogs.
Phil wasn't fooled for a moment.
And keep the dogs in a home environment.
Softy.
She made a face.
Phil laughed.
They finished up their lattes, took a copy of the security video, and exited the coffee shop, where they came face to face with none other than Flora Dane.
Dee Dee didn't require any further explanation. She said simply, "Shit."
Chapter 9.
I'd met Boston Sergeant Detective Dee Dee Warren several times before. The first had involved a crime scene featuring one serial rapist burned to a crisp, and myself, naked, wrists bound, standing over his smoking remains. She hadn't been fond of my approach then. When I decided to personally get involved with the case of a missing college student, she'd been equally unhappy with me. And yet, in a dark, boarded-up house, when I found myself cornered and armed with nothing but a plastic straw, Dee Dee Warren was the one who saved the day. Dee Dee was tough. I respected that about her. And I'd found the missing girl, which I like to think Dee Dee respected about me. Still, I'd taken pains for this afternoon's meeting. Given the media frenzy following the Stacey Summers case, I'd become more recognizable on the streets of Boston. People seemed drawn to survivors. We were at once heroic and accessible. Neighbors worth admiring, but also good for whispering about behind our backs. Hence, the continued pressure to write about my ordeal with Jacob. People wanted to know, whether I wanted them to know or not. After talking to Sarah, I'd started listening to the police scanners. Didn't take me long to hear the news that the family's two dogs had been located at a coffee shop in Brighton. Of course Dee Dee would want to check out the dogs in person, which made this the perfect place to meet. For the occasion, I wore an oversized navy blue windbreaker that added bulk to my undersized frame. It also helped disguise my various instruments of self-defense. Plastic lockpicks, a Leatherman multi-purpose tool, my custom mini pepper spray, and a combat pen that had more uses than you might think. I also wore two paracord survival bracelets. One bracelet included a compass, the other a whistle and flint fire starter. Amazing what you could find on the internet these days, especially given that the corded bracelets were currently popular with kids and available any place and every place in Boston. For the finishing touch, I'd pulled a blue Patriots cap low over my dirty blonde hair. Given this was Tom Brady country, it would have been more conspicuous to walk around in public without one. Now, Dee Dee and her fellow detective came to a halt in front of me. Dee Dee wore dark dress jeans, currently covered in white dog hair, and a caramel-colored leather jacket. I liked the jacket, but respected the dog-haired jeans. A detective not afraid to get dirty. She glanced around. Like me, aware of the public location, the potential for prying eyes, her job made her a media target. My past made me a media darling. Spotted together, we were an ambitious reporter's wet dream.
"Don't suppose you're just in the area," Dee Dee said. The other detective peeled off, approaching the uniform guarding the two dogs and murmuring something low in the officer's ear.
"Are those her dogs?" I asked. Stupid question, but I had to start somewhere.
"Whose dogs?"
I flashed her an impatient look. Roxy's.
Dee Dee turned and started walking, heading up the block. I fell in step beside her. As we passed the dogs, her colleague, Phil, I think was his name, also joined our procession.
I told the officer to stay with the dogs for another hour, Phil murmured to Dee Dee. Hopefully we'll hear from Hector by then, if not.
Are the dogs going to be all right? I asked sharply. With the family dead, Roxana missing, I hadn't even thought about the spaniels.
Dee Dee shook her head. Talk first, she ordered, never breaking stride. After that, we'll see if I'm in a sharing sort of mood.
I took a deep breath in, let it out.
All right, in for a penny, in for a pound.
I've never met her, I said, at least not in person.
Not helping.
I have a group, I shrugged, feeling suddenly self-conscious. I'm not the only survivor in Boston.
Dee Dee glanced at me.
Okay.
After the Stacy Summers case, I was in the spotlight for a bit.
Okay.
Which brought out future husbands, TV producers, and all the other assorted fruits and nuts.
When I said start talking, I meant about something relevant to the case.
I also started receiving letters from other survivors, women and men, with stories of their own. Considering how I'd helped rescue Stacy, they wondered if my approach...
Chasing predators, endangering yourself and others?
Dee Dee interjected coolly.
Might work for them.
So, I started holding meetings.
Dee Dee stopped. Caught mid-step, I stumbled slightly, had to catch myself.
Phil, on the other hand, paused easily, expression unconcerned, as Dee Dee squared off against me in the middle of the crowded block.
You started holding meetings, as in, like, you're a leader? Peter Pan with your own group of lost boys? Or Robin Hood with his merry band of thieves?
Or a support group, where we try to figure out this whole business of living in the real world again?
Dee Dee stared at me. Crystalline blue eyes. I remembered that about her. An uncompromising face to go with an uncompromising woman. She was too thin, like me. All hard angles and planes. But with her short blonde curls and penetrating blue eyes, she could be beautiful if she wanted. Except I don't think she wanted. Strength mattered more to her. To both of us. And we made our choices accordingly.
What does Samuel think of this? She asked abruptly, referring to my FBI victim advocate, and probably one of the only people in the world I truly trusted.
I hesitated.
He thinks a support group is a good idea. Be empowered and all that.
And your mom?
Given that she's pretty happy with Samuel, they're together?
Dee Dee was caught off guard enough to end the staring contest.
Finally? Well, that explains a few things.
My turn for shock.
You knew?
Dee Dee shrugged.
That explains a few things, she repeated.
Huh.
What?
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure you out.
That makes two of us.
Fresh eye roll. Tell me about Roxana Baez, Dee Dee said. Why are you here?
I saw the Amber Alert this morning and immediately recognized her name. She's already been brought to my attention.
She's one of your band of survivors?
Kind of. Roxana Baez recently talked to one of the other members of my group, looking for help. Not for herself, but for a friend.
Seriously?
Yeah, I know. Oldest line in the world. I'm going to go out on a limb and say she was probably looking for help for herself.
What kind of help?
If you'd like, you can judge that for yourself. I come bearing gifts. Transcripts from a chat room.
We'd halted across the street from a looming medical complex, St. Elizabeth's. Dee Dee glanced at the building, then at Phil. They exchanged a look.
We didn't find a record on the girl's computer that she had logged into any chat rooms, Dee Dee said.
You won't. This chat room doesn't exist. At least, not anymore.
I turned to Phil, held out a sheaf of folded papers.
And you know this how? Phil asked sharply.
Because I'm the chat room leader, and I'm good at making things both appear and disappear.
Dee Dee nodded, clearly not surprised, and apparently already one step ahead.
It's time for more coffee, she announced.
Good news. You get to join us.
Where?
Has to be a coffee shop in the med center. And as long as we're there... She and Phil exchanged that look again. I was probably in trouble. Wouldn't be the first time. I get the gunslinger seat, I called.
Somehow, I never doubted you'd have it any other way.
Chapter 10
They found the hospital cafe, but even Dee Dee could handle only so much caffeine. She went with water. Then, upon second thought, added a bagel with cream cheese. God only knew when she'd be able to eat again. Phil joined her. Flora declined all. Woman probably didn't eat anything she didn't prepare herself, or pass through poison control.
"You're bleeding," Dee Dee said to Flora once they were all situated. She nodded toward Flora's hand.
The woman raised her left arm self-consciously. She had a bandage over the meaty edge of her palm. Sure enough, red notes had bloomed across the white surface. Flora shrugged, lowered her arm again.
"What'd you do?" Dee Dee asked.
"You know how it is. All the hand-to-hand combat training. Hard not to leave without at least one or two reminders of your time on the mat."
Dee Dee nodded, though in her experience, self-defense training led to bruising, sometimes abrasions. For a wound to still be bleeding like that made her think of a gash, which made her wonder just what kind of training Flora was into these days. Phil had taken the chat room transcript. Now he spread the pages out on the table.
"No URL, IP address."
He regarded Flora skeptically. "This is beyond sanitized. For all we know, you typed this up. Script from a play."
Dee Dee saw his point. The pages basically held lines of dialogue assigned to various usernames. No way of authenticating. Worthless as real evidence went.
"I'm the chat room leader," Flora said, as if reading their minds. "If anything, you have my testimony, just like any other witnesses, that this is what I heard."
"So who are these people?" Dee Dee asked. Flora pointed halfway down the page to a user identified as BFF123.
"That's Roxana Baez."
"And you know this?"
"Because the chat room is by private invitation only. As the leader, I register the new member, and we only accept based on personal recommendation."
"Meaning someone in your group personally met Roxy?"
Flora didn't say anything.
"You know we're going to need to talk to that person, directly. Not everything can be because the great survivalist Flora Dane said so."
Flora merely arched a brow. Even Phil was exasperated.
"Are you helping us, or are you helping us?"
"Reading the transcript of this particular chat," Flora supplied coolly, "you'll notice the topic."
"Massachusetts Castle Law," Dee Dee read. Castle law referred to the rights homeowners had in their own dwelling, specifically the right to defend their lives and property in said dwelling. Laws varied state by state, which, in a region as tightly packed as New England, could lead to confusion.
Roxy brought it up, in reference to her friend. "In Massachusetts, what were the gun laws regarding self-defense?"
"Fox girl," Dee Dee read. "That's you, isn't it?"
Flora nodded.
"Well, according to you, then, Massachusetts castle law permits deadly force by a homeowner against an intruder only in cases of direct fear of bodily harm."
"Can't shoot a guy stealing your TV," Flora deadpanned. "Can shoot a guy attacking you with a weapon."
"Fists remain a gray area. Some would argue an unarmed opponent throwing punches doesn't rise to the level of imminent danger. Though, in the case of a teenage girl, she could probably argue a grown man coming directly at her incited reasonable fear of bodily harm."
Dee Dee didn't need to be educated on Massachusetts gun laws. The notoriously liberal state was not exactly an NRA stronghold and never would be. New Hampshire, to the north, however, with its motto of "live free or die"?
Phil asked the next question.
"There appears to be four different people commenting on the subject. You've blacked out the other names.
Everyone has a right to privacy."
"Because when you were a victim, you never had any?"
Dee Dee asked dryly.
"Partly, but also because survival turned us all into instant celebrities. And who wants to be famous for this?"
Dee Dee glanced up.
"You questioned if Roxy's friend had a gun. You advised against it."
She pointed to the lines of the transcript.
"Interesting advice coming from you."
Statistically speaking, guns aren't a great self-defense strategy for females. Unless they invest in training and establish comfort with their weapon, most will hesitate to pull the trigger, or they'll fire wildly, missing their target, at which time they'll lose their gun and have it used against them. As the group leader, I knew Roxana was a 16-year-old girl. I'm assuming her friend is a teenager as well, meaning the firearm is most likely a street weapon and there's been little training involved. What do you recommend for women? A dog, especially certain breeds that no one, not even an armed intruder, wants to mess with. You don't have a dog. I live in a tiny Boston apartment, not exactly dog-friendly. Roxana had two dogs, Dee Dee said. Two elderly spaniels. How fearsome is that? The waitress brought water, bagels. Dee Dee and Phil dug in. Flora stared at the table. I don't think Roxy had a friend, she said abruptly, and not just because it's the oldest line in the book. You think she felt personally threatened? Our mutual acquaintance, Flora stressed the word, who recommended Roxy for the group. She thought the girl looked stressed and exhausted. Who carries the weight of the world on their shoulders for a friend? A BFF? Dee Dee asked dryly. Read the questions she's asking, all related to self-defense, not offense, and particularly self-defense in the home. Who lives with their BFF? Dee Dee shrugged. Maybe you're right. Maybe she's simply looking for the best way to frame a shooting in order to get away with it. By that logic, she should have remained in her home this morning, argued someone in the house attacked her and she killed them in self-defense. That would keep with advice given in this transcript. Dee Dee raised a brow. She killed her entire family in self-defense, including her 9-year-old brother? Are you sure there was only one shooter? One person killed them all? Versus what? An attacker took out the family, then Roxana took out the attacker? Why not? Dee Dee wasn't surprised by the question. No details of the homicides had been leaked to the press, as it should be in such a case. I will give you this much, she granted at last. There's no evidence of an argument, disturbance, or exchange of fire. All signs point to one shooter ambushing four targets. Cold, clinical, controlled. This was planned and carried through. An execution, Flora whispered. Most likely. Flora frowned. You really think Roxana could do such a thing? I mean, this was a 16-year-old girl under pressure asking for advice on Massachusetts gun laws. But to take out her entire family, including two younger siblings, I don't buy it. Not the Roxana I knew. No way. Except according to you, you'd only just met her, meaning you didn't really know the girl at all. The Amber Alert said to be on the lookout for a girl walking two dogs. Doesn't that imply she was gone at the time of the shooting? According to neighbors, she'd left with the dogs, but that doesn't mean she didn't double back. Flora frowned again, shook her head. She didn't speak right away. Dee Dee used the opportunity to attack her bagel. Our group is small, Flora said finally, and not stupid. You go through the situations we went through, plus navigate everything afterwards, the reporters who pretend to be your best friend only because they want exclusive rights to your story, the people who suddenly love you but only really want to bask in the reflected glow of your celebrity. You learn to be a good judge of people. We don't allow many in, and everyone has to come with a personal recommendation. Roxy got that blessing. She convinced at least one pretty savvy woman that she was desperately in need. Maybe, Dee Dee shrugged, chewed more bagel. But according to you, she always talked about a friend, which everyone knew was a lie. So you believe her fear was genuine, even as she lied to you? We believe she lied because she was afraid. Tricky proposition. She reveal anything personal? Trust you guys with any intimate details of her life? Hell, the name of this alleged best friend, or, better yet, biggest enemy? Not yet. But she was new to the group. Sharing takes time and trust. Dee Dee rolled her eyes. In other words, you know nothing, and have spent the past 20 minutes telling us nothing. Thanks a lot. We didn't know much about her current home life, Flora said abruptly, but I know she was once in foster care. Dee Dee paused mid-bagel, remembered what Hector had told them about the year when Juanita's drinking had caught up with her and she'd lost custody of the kids. What makes you say that? She referred once to her CASA advocate, advice she'd received from the woman on how to handle uncomfortable situations. Basically, threat assessment skills for a foster kid entering a new home environment. Clearly, Roxana had some experience. What else? You tell me. When Roxy went for her walk, did she take anything with her? Say, a backpack? Maybe. Flora nodded, as if that made perfect sense. Bug-out bag. She was preparing, keeping the essentials with her at all times. Something foster kids learn to do. Except Roxy's been back home with her mother and siblings for years now. Seems like a strange time to suddenly expect a social worker or CASA volunteer to show up again. Or that's what had Roxy on edge. Something had changed recently in the home. Roxy recognized the signs from before, and that's what had her on edge. Dee Dee frowned. It was an interesting theory, and yet she had no way of evaluating how interesting, because when it came to the Baez family, they simply didn't know enough yet. I assume your little band of misfits gave advice on proper stocking of a bug-out bag? Dee Dee asked. We're big fans of cash, bear spray, nondescript clothes, and duct tape, Flora said. What about advice on purchasing street weapons? Like I said, I don't recommend firearms for these situations. Except what's the situation? Dee Dee asked in exasperation. Someone fearing for her life. From whom? Because if she was afraid of her mother's boyfriend, then he should be dead on her bedroom floor while she claims self-defense. But what the hell justifies the shooting of her entire family? Just proves an outsider did it. Maybe someone who was there to hunt Roxy, or, failing that, wanted to leave her alone and vulnerable. Have you or anyone else in your group heard from her? Lie to me, and I'll arrest you. All of you. We've had no contact. But you'll tell me the minute you do. Flora remained mute. Are you helping us, or are you helping us? Dee Dee asked, tensely. We're helping her. Great. Tell me where she'd go under stress. Maybe a location your group has identified just for these circumstances. If you fear you're being followed, I recommend going someplace public, with plenty of witnesses. Dee Dee growled low in her throat. Roxana was a big reader. You might consider the library. Less of a growl. I don't know what's going on here, Flora said. I really don't, but I'm worried for her. I doubt Roxy's a killer. I think she's a victim. Based on quality time together in a chat room that no longer exists? Yes. You know what I get from all this? Dee Dee lifted the transcript pages. I have a missing 16-year-old girl who's been asking questions about firearms, which makes me believe that somewhere in that backpack of hers, she may very well have a gun, and has done her research on how to use it. Flora leaned forward. She took care of her dogs, tied them under a tree in the shade with plenty of water. Does a heartless girl do that? A stone-cold killer? She made every effort to keep them safe. Maybe, if she'd been home when the killer came, she would have kept her family safe, too. Because that's what you'd do? She's not you, Flora. In fact, we don't know who she is at all. Once again, if she contacts you, I'll be the first to help her. So help me God. But Flora was already pushing away from the table. Once more, Dee Dee's gaze went to the bloody bandage on her left hand. You do what you need to do, Detective, and I'll do what I need to do. And maybe, if we're both lucky, Roxana Baez will turn up safe and sound. Then you can catch the person who murdered her family while I help her with the aftermath. It's not going to be that simple. It's never simple. Flora, if I learn anything interesting, I'll let you know, which is a good deal, because we both know you won't do the same. Flora turned, walked away. Dee Dee and Phil watched until she disappeared into the crowd. Don't trust that girl, Phil said. You think? He picked up the copies of the transcript. Anything there you can use? Dee Dee asked, as Phil was their squad's self-appointed geek. There's always something, just don't know what yet. But you have an idea? Dee Dee asked, hopefully. Phil nodded slowly. Flora might have sanitized things from her end, but we have Roxy's computer, remember? And the thing about computers is that they love data. Even stuff a user thinks she's deleted. It's all stashed on the hard drive somewhere. I say give the transcripts to the real experts and let them go fishing. If they can match these lines with anything in the computer's browser history, temporary download file, especially, say, if Roxy copied anything from the group's forum for future reference, great idea. And thank God, because Phil, we're running out of time, he finished for her.
Yeah,
and with a 16-year-old girl running around Brighton with a possible handgun in her backpack. Was the shooting this morning the end, or just the beginning?
Exactly.
Chapter 11. Under stress, my mother bakes. Blueberry muffins, chocolate chip brownies, strawberry jam cupcakes. Most of my childhood memories were of myself sitting in an overheated kitchen while my mom bustled around, mixing this, pouring that, and the smells. I associated mornings with seared-edged blueberry pancakes and trickling rivers of warmed maple syrup. After school was fresh bread or, if my brother and I were really lucky, cinnamon sugar-dusted snickerdoodles. I was told that during the 472 days I was gone, the entire community grew fat on all the cookies, cupcakes, breads, brownies my mother churned out of the kitchen. I bet she needed the focus, the soothing rhythm of stir this, add that, the simple equation of these seven ingredients will yield this sheet of goodies time after time. Baking. My mother is in control of what will happen next. There's not much in life that offers that. When I returned home after my abduction, she concentrated on making all my favorite foods. Fattening me up, she was probably thinking, but never said the words out loud. Jacob wasn't a big fan of feeding his captives. I'd starve for days. Then he'd show up suddenly with bags and bags of junk food, whatever craving struck his fancy. Fried chicken, biscuits and gravy, French fries and milkshakes. He was a very impulsive man, driven to satisfy his immediate appetites. And he had the swollen gut and stick-figure limbs to prove it. My first day at home, sitting in my mother's kitchen again, slowly biting into one of her blueberry muffins, I cried. I ate it with tears rolling down my cheeks. She sat beside me, held my hand. My brother was still around, standing in the doorway. I remember him watching us. I remember being embarrassed and grateful, and overwhelmed. I remember thinking, I'm home. This is what home tastes like. I think I was happy at that moment. I didn't understand yet how fleeting that emotion would be, that my mother's baking days were far from over, that my brother's role standing on the outside and looking in would eventually drive him to leave us completely. We want to generalize our experiences. Being kidnapped and held captive, that was bad. Being safely home, that is good. But the truth is, any situation contains both highs and lows. Jacob and I used to play the license plate game in his big rig driving across the interstate. That was good. I woke up screaming in my own home. That was bad. You can't separate it all out. I had a rape survivor tell me she thought of her post-trauma emotions as being like old European plumbing. On one side of the sink is a faucet for cold. On the other side is the faucet for hot. You can turn both on, but the streams don't mix. They're forever separate. Two halves to one plumbing hole. I liked that analogy. I had a spout for all my trauma emotions and a spout for my real life. They existed side by side, but didn't mix. And some days I poured more out of one faucet than the other. And some days I went back and forth, strung out and sleep-deprived, yet breaking out into spontaneous laughter at something I saw on TV. One faucet on, the other suddenly kicking in. Just like there are times you can be happy, having a good day, and yet there's still a shadow around your vision, a creeping sense that this can't last. The worst is yet to come. I didn't cook under stress. I didn't clean. I'd tried meditation and mindfulness and a bunch of other stuff to calm my squirrel brain and give me at least a minute or two where I wasn't assessing the latest possible threat and revving up with fresh suspicion. But I wasn't good at any of that. I liked to fight. I liked to run. And I liked to read. Hours and hours of studying other cases, reviewing other missing persons reports. If I examined each case closely enough, maybe I could be the one to find the key to the puzzle that brings that person home again. It was how I first got involved with the missing Boston College student, and it was why I became more and more interested in Roxana Baez. My mother bakes to feel in control. Me? I'm still trying to save the world. So I met with Sergeant Warren and the Phil guy. I told them what I knew about Roxy Baez. And then, after they politely but firmly dismissed me from the investigation, I did what I do best. I went hunting. I didn't have a cop's authority to ask questions of potential witnesses or suspects, but I did have a survivor's network of contacts and a comfort with lying, which brought me to the doorstep of Tricia Lobdell Cass, guidance counselor at Brighton High School, shortly after 1 on Saturday. She answered at my first knock, cracking the door wide enough to expose one leg and a shoulder, the half-welcome someone gives a non-threatening but unknown person standing on her front porch. I wondered what people dreaded more, uniformed officers or door-to-door salespeople. "My name is Florence," I said, as the name Flora Dane was well known in Boston. "I'm a friend of the Baez family, a neighbor. I was hoping you could help me with the dogs." The guidance counselor's eyes widened at the name Baez. Clearly, she'd heard the news. But my follow-up inquiry about the dogs had thrown her for a loop, which was what I'd hoped. I didn't know if guidance counselors had doctor-patient confidentiality with their students, but I figured at the very least they'd feel an obligation to protect a kid's privacy. So I wasn't asking about Roxana. Why go straight for the no when you can work sideways into a maybe? "I'm not sure I understand," she began. "The police have found the family's dogs, Rosie and Blaze, sweetest dogs in the world. I'm sure you've heard Roxana talk about them."
"Yes. They can't exactly go home right now."
"Oh, well, of course not. And we feel it would be awful if they ended up with animal control, locked up in a strange kennel, sleeping on a concrete floor, abandoned."
"Oh, so I volunteered to see if I could find someone who could take both dogs. A neighbor mentioned your name as the guidance counselor at the high school. I thought you'd know some of Roxy's friends. Maybe one of them might be willing to take the dogs for a bit?"
Okay. I'm not sure how much help I'll be, but I can try." The woman opened the door, and I walked in, just like that. I wondered if this was how Jacob felt every time a new victim granted him entrance. Tricia Lobdell Cass lived in the lower level of a triple-decker, bay windows, crown molding, worn wood floors. She had a flair for potted plants, ivy and jade and ferns grouped in front of windows, on top of tables. The sitting room also held piles of books and a broken-down blue sofa covered in orange, red, and hot pink pillows. "It's beautiful," I said, this time telling the truth. Tricia walked over to the sofa. She indicated that I could take a seat, but remained standing herself. She seemed anxious, like she wasn't sure what to do. First time dealing with a missing student, I figured. Or something else.
"Water?" she asked belatedly.
"No, thank you." Since she remained standing, I did the same.
Any word on Roxy?" she asked.
"Not that I've heard."
"And the dogs?"
"They were left tied up outside a coffee shop. Both appear perfectly fine."
"But the rest of the family? They're not giving many details on the news, but it sounds like they're all dead."
She glanced up at me. I didn't see any fear in the counselor's eyes, just grief.
"Yes," I said.
She exhaled hard and sat, just like that, as if a string had been cut, leading her to collapse. I took a seat on the sofa next to her. The school counselor looked younger than I expected, maybe late 20s, early 30s, long brunette hair, pretty.
"I think the police suspect Roxy," I murmured low, one neighbor to another,
"that she just happened to be gone when this all happened."
"What? That's ridiculous. Roxy wouldn't hurt a fly.
And trust me, as a high school counselor, I know just what kind of sociopaths masquerade as America's teens these days. But Roxy? Never."
"I always saw her out with the dogs," I offered. "She seemed really good with them."
Please, Roxy has practically raised her younger sister and baby brother. She's one of the most responsible students we have. Ask any teacher in the school. If they could clone 100 more Roxys, they would. I dropped my voice lower. Are the parents not that involved? I don't know. I've only met them once. They both work a lot. Night nurse at the medical center, an overworked building contractor. My impression is that they're very busy juggling daily demands. Add to that 3 kids in 3 different schools. She shrugged. Roxy was doing her best to help out, though sometimes at a cost to herself. Last year we had an issue with her being tardy several times in a row. Turned out, she was having trouble getting her younger sister to the middle school on time. Once we figured that out, I followed up with her mother. But the truth is that Juanita isn't home from her graveyard shift yet, and Charlie is already out on a job site. Meaning the morning churn is Roxy's responsibility, and she's old enough to legally be in charge. In the end, I had a chat with Roxy's teachers. Given that she's never late with homework and pays attention once she's in class, they agreed to let the tardy slip slide. It's the best we can do to help a family that's doing the best they can do. I didn't know anything about these kinds of situations, but I nodded my head in sympathy. Sounds like you're very understanding. Another shrug. That's my job, to help kids navigate school and home and real life. There's a lot of pressure on teenagers these days. Roxy have a lot of friends? I asked. Sounds like she's very nice. You mean, is she popular? No. She's quiet. Mostly, you see her sitting at lunch with a book. BFF123, I thought, not surprised by Roxy's deception, especially not as I sat there and continued lying myself. A big reader? Definitely. Great student? Above average. Reading and writing are her passion. I know she's been working on an essay series that Mrs. Chula, the writing teacher, can't stop raving about. She wants Roxy to enter the pieces in a statewide writing competition, but Roxy refused.
Really? What's the essay about?
I'm not sure. Something about the perfect family. I know the first 2 installments made Mrs. Chula cry.
What does Roxy read? I asked, mostly because I was curious.
Oh, all those fantasy books, the ones where average kids turn out to have hidden warrior powers and are the only ones who can save the world. Typical hero's journey stuff.
This intrigued me. Would Roxy and I have liked each other if we'd gotten to spend more time together? She, a family protector, me, a self-appointed vigilante. I didn't read much. Maybe she would have held that against me. Plus, in the books, I'm pretty sure the badass heroines are beautiful versus my own ragged self with my hollowed-out cheekbones and torn fingernails. But still,
I did have one concern. The counselor was saying now.
Yeah?
We have this group of Hispanic girls. I've heard whispers they're a gang. They all have beauty marks on their cheeks and a penchant for ripped-up jeans. According to the rumor mill, Roxy's sister Lola has already joined the middle school group. Now Roxy's under pressure from the high school girls. I've been keeping my eye on the situation. Nothing crazy has happened yet. My impression is that Roxy's playing it smart. She doesn't directly tell anyone no, just keeps saying later. Right now she's got to pick up her sister, grab her brother, walk the dogs, whatever. It's been keeping them at bay.
For now, I said.
Yes.
And if she can't keep stalling them?
One of those shrugs again. Girls, especially a clique of girls, they can make Roxy's life miserable.
How so? Physical threats? Actual beatdowns? I've heard girl gangs can be worse than boys.
Oh, trust me. It used to be that girls would exchange insults while boys would throw punches. Now, the girls go at it just as hard, often armed with box cutters, razors, you name it. Which is why not so much as a butter knife is allowed on school grounds.
But after school, not on school property?
Trisha looked me in the eye. I can't control everything. And yes, anger the wrong group of kids, and any high schooler's life gets tough. I've heard stories of brawls involving chains, studded belts, baseball bats. When I tell parents their kids are under a lot of stress, I'm not lying.
Roxy was an outsider, a loner, I said.
Yes.
Meaning she had that stress?
Yes.
And no friends at all to help her?
Tricia hesitated.
There's a boy. Right now, that's the only person I can picture her with. Another loner type, to tell you the truth.
Sometimes you'd see them sitting together in the commons area.
Is he her boyfriend?
I don't know.
His name?
Mike. Mike Davis. He's, a bit different. But he and Roxy seem to get along. Frankly, I was grateful to see them together. He is another student for whom school life can be pretty rough.
Do you have his address?
Yes, but I'm not going to give it to you. I stilled, looked at the guidance counselor.
Flora Dane, she said quietly. It took me a bit. When you first appeared, I had that sense of déjà vu. It's because I've seen you on TV.
You helped rescue the college student last fall.
Yes.
You don't live next to Roxy.
I care about the dogs, I offered, because I had to say something.
Why are you really here?
I know Roxy. She's part of a support group I belong to. We're worried about her.
A support group?
I didn't offer any more details. After another moment, the guidance counselor nodded slightly.
What happened to Roxy's family? She asked.
I don't know.
But you don't think she did it?
I think she's in trouble. Have you noticed any changes in the past few weeks? Is she late more often? Stressed? Missing homework assignments? Mentioned anything to anyone?
No, but it's a very large school. I can go days without seeing a student.
Unless something specific happens that's brought to my attention, I nodded.
I can't give you a student's information, the counselor said at last. But if you want to give me your cell, I can ask Roxy's friend to call you.
Fair enough.
The dogs really have been found?
Yes, and they really do need some place to stay.
All right, I can work on that too.
I rose to standing.
Thank you.
At the last minute, as Tricia opened the door, she hesitated.
Remember what I was saying about this group of Hispanic girls trying to recruit Roxy?
I nodded.
I'm told Roxy's younger sister, Lola, is more than just a little involved in the gang.
I don't know if you've ever met Lola, but she's very pretty. Dangerously so, for a 13-year-old girl.
I waited.
She's also, from what I've been told, very aware of her own looks.
Manipulative, I filled in. I don't think she joined the group just to hang out.
From what I've heard and seen, Roxy is the responsible member of her family, while where her younger sister goes, trouble usually follows.
Are we talking drugs? Violence?
I'm not sure.
But a bunch of rabid teen girls?
Anything's possible.
Chapter 12.
Name, Roxana Baez. Grade 11. Teacher, Mrs. Chula. Category, personal narrative. What is the perfect family? Part 2. My little sister and I stand in the ratty living room. The pinch-faced lady is with us. She has a tight grip on my shoulder, as if she thinks I'll bolt any minute. On the other side of me, Lola is wedged up so close I can feel her trembling. Manny is gone. I can't think about it. Lola won't stop crying. The police took him out the door, and there was another lady. No purple blouse, but a white shirt and the same firm, sorry expression. We'd never even seen her pull up. Somehow they'd outflanked us. I feel betrayed, but I'm not sure why. Maybe I'm just disappointed in myself, because for all my hard work, I didn't see this coming.
Pack, the pinch-faced lady told us.
Pack what?
Lola stared at me, so I pulled her away. We had our school backpacks. That was it.
I took ours down from the hooks, refusing to look at Manny's red Iron Man bag. He hadn't even been allowed clothes, or his favorite car. Why hadn't he been allowed to take anything?
My pack is powder blue. It fit me when I was 8. Now it's tight in the shoulders, but still gets the job done.
Lola has a hot pink backpack, newer. Manny's dad, Hector, bought it for her before he left. He was always nice to Lola and me. He stayed with our mom for 5 years, which was 5 more years than we had with our own fathers.
Clothes. Laundry money ran out weeks ago. I'd been washing underwear and socks in the sink. They were still damp, draped over radiators, windowsills, anything I could find. Wordlessly, I handed Lola hers, then took mine. Lola had a stuffed blue dog. I found our toothbrushes. At the last minute, I spotted a sock. Little, black, one of Manny's, stuck beneath a closet door. I picked it up. It smelled of sweaty toddler feet. I stuck it in the front pocket of my backpack. Then we left. And now we're here. The foster woman is huge, nearly as wide as she is tall, with a double, double chin. A quadruple chin? She wears a blue house coat, and her hair is a mass of black and gray brillo around her rotund face. Standing behind her are four kids, three boys, one girl. They all stare at me. Then, as one, turn their attention to Lola. The tallest boy smirks. He nudges the older girl, a blonde, in a way I don't like. Beside them, a shorter, skinny boy is rocking and bouncing on his feet. He won't meet my gaze, just jangles away. "This is Roxana," the pinch-faced lady introduces, shaking my shoulder, who is 11, and her younger sister Lola, who's 8.
"Call me Mother Dell," the massive woman instructs.
Lola and I nod slowly. The big lady holds out a hand. We shake it.
"This is Roberto." She pulls the largest boy forward. 13. Anya, 12. Sam, 10. And this one...
She pokes the skinny, bouncy boy.
"He's 11. Same age as you, Roxana. We call him Mike."
His gaze pops up, meets mine for a brief second. His body stills. Then his gaze slides away, and his bouncing resumes.
"We don't have many girls, as you can tell. Roxana..."
"Roxy."
"Roxy, you could sleep on a cot in Anya's room. Lola, being one of the younger ones, will put you in with the babies."
There are babies in this house? Behind the woman, I can see the kid Mike moving again. He slowly but surely shakes his head. "No, thank you," I hear myself say. "I'll stay with Lola in the baby's room as well. I'm a big help."
"Nonsense. Not enough room. If you really want to help with the babies, you can have that room, and Lola will stay with Anya instead."
The bouncy boy shakes his head harder. Spotting his actions, the bigger kid, Roberto, punches his shoulder. "I'll stay with my sister," I say again.
"There's not enough.
We'll both sleep on the floor with the babies, and we'll both help. We're good at that. We have... had a baby brother." The woman frowns at me, the folds of her face deepening. She doesn't know what to do with me. On the other side of me, Lola is still trembling uncontrollably. She has a death grip on my hand. I can feel her fingernails digging in. Briefly, I can see Manny again, hear him crying, "Roxy, Roxy, Roxy, no!" A ripple goes through my body. I catch it. Soldier on. Lola and I don't have dads, just our mom, and she's gone. But Manny has Hector. He loved Manny. Before that last fight, Hector's fist smashing through the wall before he went thundering out the door and didn't come back. If I can just figure out a way to reach him, tell him about Manny, I know he'll come for Manny. And maybe, if I ask really nice, he'll take Lola and me too. I'm a big help, I swear it. I can be such a big help.
"Let them stay with the babies for a bit,"
the pinch-faced lady is saying. She has finally relaxed her grip on my shoulder. "Until the girls get settled."
"I guess."
There's not much to talk about after that. The pinch-faced lady leaves. Lola and I are escorted upstairs by the girl, Anya, who has long strawberry blonde hair and exotic greenish-gold eyes. She would be beautiful, except she has a way of smiling at us that's not really smiling. She reminds me of a grinning cat, happy to have new toys to play with. There are babies. 3. Wedged into a room barely big enough for a single nursery. I don't see how Lola was ever going to fit on the floor, given the 3 cribs. I definitely don't know how both of us are going to do it. But we will, because we can't be alone. I'm starting to understand that. Whatever happens in this house, never get caught alone. Anya's room is across from the baby's. She has a twin-sized mattress on the floor. There is room for one more, but I'm sticking with the nursery. Next to her is a larger room, 3 cots for the 3 boys. Manny could have fit, I think. But suddenly, I'm grateful he's not here. Clanging downstairs. Dinner bell, Anya says. That smirk again. She leads us back to the kitchen. There are 2 tables, 1 for boys, 1 for girls. A new arrangement, just for us. We say grace and pass around a large bowl of pasta and red sauce. It's plain, but it's the first hot meal Lola and I have eaten in a bit. We start shoveling before catching ourselves. The others are staring.